Morning. This meeting of the House Education Committee will come to order. Today is Friday, March 24th, and the time is 8:05 a.m. Members of House Education present are Vice Chair Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Ivy Sponholz, Representative Zach Fansler, Representative Jennifer Johnston, Representative Chuck Kopp, Representative Dave Tallarico, and myself, Representative Harriet Drummond. We have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone to silence their cell phones. Today, our recording secretary is Kelly Burnett, and Matt Kern is our LIO moderator assisting with tech and teleconferencing support. Thank you both. My aide, Patrick Fitzgerald, will be helping us out today. Kristen Cranendonk, our intrepid education aide, is sick today, and hopefully we have all the documents we need, if not in front of us, on basis. The ghost. Has the ghost moved over from 124?
Must have.
Today, we will be talking more about broadband. In February, we had service providers come in and speak with the committee, and there were a lot of questions, so I really wanted to do a follow-up meeting. We'll start with Ms. Pigeon from GCI in just a minute. We will also be hearing from Alaska Satellite Internet to talk to us about low-orbit satellites and what technological changes we can expect in the next few years. I want to thank Representative Tallarico for helping us line up this presentation. I'm excited to hear more from them today. At the meeting in February, we specifically had a lot of questions about Quintillion, and so we have them on the line to talk with us the second half of this meeting. We will finish up today with a presentation from Star of the Northwest Magnet School to hear more about what schools are currently doing with the technology they already have. So we have a full schedule this morning. We are going to start with Tina Pigeon from GCI. Tina, if you could come up, place your name on the record, and make your presentation. Welcome to Juneau this morning. Looks like you're bringing the clearing for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take the credit, but I'm sure I don't deserve it. Good morning to the members of the committee. Madam Chair, thank you for having me back again. My name is Tina Pigeon. I'm GCI's General Counsel. And when I was last here, we talked about broadband in the schools and also more specifically, an overview of broadband network capabilities. And when last year, I know there were a number of questions about satellites, and you may have other items on your mind as well, and I'm here to answer those questions.
Questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, and I'm not sure now if this is the time because, as you know, I've been asking quite a bit about low-orbital satellites, but we're going to be having a presentation, so would you rather just be on board to answer any other questions if we have some?
Through the chair, whatever the preference is, I'm available to what makes sense for your process.
Okay. I'm going to take an at-ease.
Okay. Here today. So the FCC Alaska plan that was approved gave a substantial financial commitment to telecoms in Alaska, and I think for GCI it was about $60 million a year. And my question is, that's exciting to see where that broadband, where that, I should say, fiber optic or build out is going, and I'm just curious where that development trail is going to go throughout rural Alaska. And have you mapped it out? Are you able to comment and tell us where that investment is going? We've been hearing a lot about it in education where we really need higher speed internet, and so I'm excited to hear where the investment is going.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Kopp, just to provide a little bit of historical context, the funding that was secured under the Alaska plan is funding that has been in place for many years under the traditional, what's called the high-cost program administered by the FCC under the overall umbrella of universal service. And so that funding for many years has been supporting both traditional wireline services and wireless services. And in the past, as the programs developed, they were really framed because of when they were established around supporting voice telephony services. Starting in 2011, the FCC initiated a process to change the way the funds were administered so that instead of supporting exclusively or primarily or being framed around voice services, that instead they were focused on seeking support and advancement of broadband services. One thing I'll note is, in most ways, the network is the network, no matter what kind of service is traversing it, whether it's voice information, broadband. Typically, the pieces of the network that are used, there's substantial overlap between the two. So that's not to say in the years leading up to the FCC's transformation process that there wasn't support or advancement of broadband that was enabled through this funding in the past as well. But when the FCC took on the initiative to really make it specifically applicable to broadband, that created really some risk to Alaska providers and, more importantly, Alaskans in terms of that funding stream continuing to be available. So what the dollars that you see as a result of the efforts of working with the FCC to establish the Alaska Plan, those dollars are what is historically being provided to support underlying networks in Alaska up to date, and it froze those amounts. So now what providers have to do going forward is focus how those funds are utilized in rural Alaska and also to meet individual commitments in terms of not only maintaining the level of underlying service, so not taking service away in any community that has it, but also expanding the service capabilities in the areas where we serve. Each of the participating providers established with an iterative process with the FCC the commitments that they have to meet under the Alaska Plan, or they will not only lose part of the funding, but also incur penalties for failure to meet those advancements. For GCI, the vast majority of the funding is to support wireless performance in rural Alaska, and there are categories of service locations depending on whether they are served by microwave, fiber, or satellite. The initial five-year commitment requires us to expand service to communities so that in locations that have 2G service today, they will be advanced to either 3G or LTE at certain performance levels established by the FCC. I actually don't have the commitment chart with me today, but I'd be happy to provide it to the committee members as a follow-up. But what you will see is at the five-year mark and the 10-year mark, that there are increases north of, I think, north of 20% and 30% improvement levels measured by increased members of the population that get improved services. So it's both maintaining the level of service and not having a regression where it exists today, and also increasing the capabilities for substantial numbers of POPs or the population measured as a percentage. What we are doing right now to ensure compliance with that plan is really looking across a five-year planning horizon and determining what projects are on the radar screen that may or may not be related to this service, but ensuring that we can basically maximize the efficiency of using the resources. So if we're mobilizing heavy equipment or personnel to a certain location to do projects, that we're figuring out how to maximize the use of those resources and therefore maximize the improvements and also use of the funding so we and the communities can get the most out of it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cobb. Other questions? I have a couple on the things that you mentioned along the way. Mm-hmm. funding under the Alaska Plan has been going on for many years. I think you said under the overall umbrella.
Oh, under the overall umbrella.
Overall, okay,
yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
I think we've been having too many transportation network company meetings. Okay. Okay. And the network was established to provide voiced telephonic services.
The original network. These programs were established decades ago, mm-hmm. formalized under the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at programs that were established over that period of time, I mean, really then the mission was to support networks and voice telephony services. Clearly that there has been amazing advancement in the capabilities of networks in the intervening period of time. And so the change in the Universal Service Program has really been to ensure that rules of programs that were established decades ago were updated so that people, customers, consumers could get the benefit of the support of these programs mm-hmm. so that the efforts of the benefiting companies were actually directed at getting to broadband services. I think in many ways there really wasn't a disconnect there because, as I said, the network is the network. But at least this way, under the current plan formulations, there are specific goals related to broadband tied to the funding that's received.
And further, if the network is the network, explain what that means, because I mean, phone lines have a different capability than broadband lines, than cable, than fiber. So how is the network the network?
The piece parts of a network that are used to carry a voice service are in many ways the same fundamental infrastructure that's used to carry a broadband service or data bits. It may require different electronics, different software.
The ends of the
yes,
line.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But when we move from voice to broadband, we didn't go in and take all those pieces out. You can actually improve the capability of existing networks. Maybe over time you replace pieces of it so you can get greater capacity where it's needed. Mm-hmm. But you really can get the same performance just because of the development of technology and innovation over time.
So once you've reached a community with the network, then you continue to alter the pieces of the network as the technology requirements increase to continue to deliver.
Madam Chair, that's a fair representation of it.
Okay, and then you said that when the FCC stepped in and required upgrade to broadband, it created some risk to Alaska providers and froze the funding amounts in the Alaska plan. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by froze? Is it annual levels stay exactly the same?
Right.
They just froze in place and no more money. How do you mean they froze the funding?
Madam Chair, there was a without going too deeply into the weeds, because of the changes that the FCC initiated in 2011. There actually were some of the funding was frozen already, and what I mean by that, in the past it would vary for some carriers depending on the amount of costs they reported in a certain year. For other carriers, maybe depending on the amount of customers or lines they reported serving in a given year. When changes started to be made to the program, certain categories of that support were frozen at that point. But they were frozen, yet not committed to still be dedicated to Alaska networks. There would have been opportunities because of different potential distribution models that if the funding was subject to nationwide competition, For example, that, and you were looking at serving the most people for the least amount of money, it was possible that in head-to-head competition with other providers in other states, that Alaska would have lost funding, when I think it's fair to say and non-controversial that there is yet still insufficient funding to ensure a common level of performance statewide. Mm-hmm. And so what the FCC was able to conclude was that let's at least freeze this funding in place, and we're going to put some commitments to what carriers have to do to continue and advance service. And in that way, with a reliable amount of support over a certain period of time, then that permits the providers to have a planning horizon and say, we know what's going to be available, and therefore we can make commitments to advance services over that period of time.
So it sounds like instead of competing with lower 48 providers, they made a special arrangement for Alaska, understanding that Alaska's market can't possibly be in competition with the lower 48 because of the size, space, and number of customers, number of potential customers.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I mean, there's no the record in front of the FCC is replete with examples of the differences mm-hmm. and the challenges of serving in Alaska, mm-hmm. and that's really what the adoption of the Alaska plan ultimately recognizes.
Okay, let's see. I have one more question. The initial five-year plan was to provide improvements to, I think you said, 2G to 3G, 3G to LTE, and you were going to be providing soon a chart or a map of those intended improvements or the planned improvements.
And Madam Chair, what I will provide is we actually entered with the FCC a set of firm commitments about what those improvements would be. Mm-hmm. And what it shows is both the type of network and levels of performance and the percentages of the population and the improvements in those two time segments at 5 years and 10 years. What it won't show and what is currently in the planning stage underway is specifically over time what those communities will be. So, for example, I could demonstrate at the end of a given year where we were in terms of meeting those population commitments. But right now, I can show you what the end stage is required to be in terms of improvements at year 5 and year 10.
If it won't show over time what those communities will be, how does that help us here understanding, you know, which communities will be reached and which won't be?
I can report on an annual basis, but that is which communities really is on an iterative process, and I don't have a community by community map.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm glad that you're working to expand the degree of availability. Have you made similar commitments about affordability? In some of our communities, data costs hundreds of times more than it does in others. Are you going to be addressing that as part of your plan?
Through the chair, the issue of affordability is one that we continuously grapple with. The networks are expensive, but we also understand that, pardon me, the ultimate goal is actually to ensure that users have access to that broadband. I will tell you that the challenges when we talk about affordability, that it is somewhat useful to talk about whether we're in the category of mobile or fixed broadband. In the mobile area, we offer statewide plans, and so from that perspective, there actually shouldn't be any variability in terms of the price points. I will tell you that on the wireline side, that is not the same. That is not the same situation. That there are some differentiations in plan offerings, and we are looking at whatever way we can to address the affordability issue, and really just to ensure that we can offer the best service that we can, both technologically and economically, deliver to communities that are very challenging to serve, but at the same time provide a service that people find usable, that meets their needs, and I acknowledge it's a continued challenge and one that we're grappling with.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson, go ahead.
This is kind of an off-the-wall question, but how is this similar to back when there was the rural electrification plan? Is it because that had the same kind of challenges?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I confess that I don't know enough or really almost anything about the rural electrification plan to make that comparison. What I can say is that in terms of networks serving locations that are challenging to serve, I imagine it is a very similar challenge about how you ensure that the service is delivered, but also ensure that you can actually maintain, equip, and continue to upgrade services over time when you have very thin economic conditions. And I think it is what we have seen over time is that greater capabilities do become available, particularly as technology and economics reduce costs of service and improve efficiency in services. And I will say, going back to one of the issues I touched on or mentioned earlier, is that that's where the prospects of looking at technological advancements in terms of satellite networks could really make a difference. And I think that there's a lot of interesting developments on the horizon that could really change the landscape.
So just in a sort of a broad scope, it's serving the same purpose. It has the same problems because it's going into communities that do not have the economic capacity to provide the service. But where this is different than the old rural and consequently, the charge to the basic service needs to the educations and health is how they also reap some of their, they were the biggest payers. But what we have here is a big difference is technology, where in rural electrification, the technology was not as fast and as developing. So thank you for your answer.
Plus, it didn't have to connect to the network. You get diesel up there, you get a generator, and electricity is produced for a village. But you're talking about connections as the map show.
That's what satellites give you.
Yeah. We'll hear a little more about that. Representative Kopp, did I see a hand up for a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tina, are you exploring any partnerships with Quintillion in their build-out? I was just looking at the numbers of spurs that they have, buying any capacity from them in any partnership way. Just like to know what GCI is doing there.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, it is, as with any other provider in the market, we look at build-buy decisions. And the questions that we look at is, does the service provide us the capabilities that we need at a price point that it makes sense to purchase on the network versus building our own network? And really, those are the kinds of assessments that we make regardless of who the service provider is. I'm really not at liberty to talk about any individual arrangements with any particular company, but we look at those decisions the same way in any circumstance, and it's really based on assessing the economics of it and the technological capabilities and whether it suits the company's needs in serving our customers.
Sure. Madam Chair, just a brief follow-up.
Go ahead, Representative.
I didn't mean to you to divulge your market plan, but I just, in the sense that you receive a lot of public money and you have commitments for build-out, and I would just realize that what Quintillion offers up in the Northwest Arctic is a huge capacity for villages up there. So that was the question just coming from there, that there could be some good symbiotic partnerships that could help hopefully both of your goals be realized. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Any additional questions for Ms. Pidgeon? Representative Fansler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, last time I think that we had this meeting, it was mentioned that perhaps there was a regulatory structure in place within the states that was inhibiting kind of the buildup of these networks. Could you speak more to that?
Through the chair, Representative Fansler, I actually don't recall what you're referring to. I do know that at times that there are varying levels of regulatory oversight when it comes to permitting, siting, and the ability to deploy networks. So I think that's one way in which I think providers typically look to see, you know, are there ways to improve that process so that the process actually achieves appropriate goals in terms of review of those applications, but that also is predictable and yields timely decisions and is a reasonable process. That's one way, and maybe what had been discussed, but I'm not sure if that gets to your question.
And forgive me, I believe it may have been one of the different companies that had brought that up, mm-hmm. but I guess my point would be, is that GCI's position as well, that there are regulations on the state books that could be cleaned up, that are outdated, that would provide better clarity for accomplishing these kinds of network buildups?
Through the chair, Representative Fansler, I mean, I think anytime regulations can be improved to provide greater certainty, that's usually helpful. But I will say, from our perspective, there have not been any particular regulations that we have not been able to engage with and proceed. You know, that doesn't mean that over change in time and change of circumstances that it's not, it's often worthwhile to review those regulations. The only thing I'll say about that is, once regulations have been in place for a certain period of time, then you have built up some familiarity with how to work with them and what it requires. And so I will say, change can be good, but it can also introduce additional uncertainty because now you have a new set of regulations to deal with, but really no new understanding. You have to develop all that precedent over again. So I can see both sides of that equation, but I'm happy to engage in any particular discussion about a particular regulation should a review be undertaken.
Further, Representative Fowler.
Further follow-up for the chair, actually. Mm-hmm. Will it be possible perhaps to hear our presentations and then if we have additional questions that are brought up?
Absolutely. I believe our speakers will be hanging around. And we have a timing issue with the speaker from Quintillion, so we'll have lots of time.
Okay.
So gather your questions and we'll... you're able to be with us for the whole 2 hours.
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Pidgeon at this time?
Just one.
Go ahead, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that when considering cooperating with Quintillion, the options you brought up were build or buy. Is there a share option in there somewhere?
Through the chair, there are arrangements that network providers engage in which they swap capacity. That's sometimes an arrangement also.
Okay. Because I know that in electrical utilities, there's a very clear rule about the necessity of sharing capacity, and you're allowed to charge others what you charge yourself, plus a reasonable return on investment. Is it also the case for the broadband utility?
Through the chair, I think there are different standards of both practice and law that apply, but I don't know that it is as particular as what it sounds like you're describing in the electric space.
Thank you.
All right. We are going to let Ms. Pigeon step away from the microphone, and we're supposed to have Christina Woolston from Quintillion on, but she's not on yet. I believe she's stepping away from a board meeting. I'm going to take an at ease for a moment so we can figure out where we are in the schedule. Again, apologies. Back on the record. Up next is Alaska Satellite Internet. And thank you, Ms. Pigeon. That was a terrific discussion. It raised a lot of questions, and I'm sure there will be more. Good morning. Welcome to the House Education Committee meeting. Can you give us your name and officially for the record and who you're affiliated with, and begin your presentation?
Well, thank you. I'm Will Johnson from Alaska Satellite Internet, and I've been in Alaska over 30 years, a lifelong dream to be here. Unfortunately, I wasn't born here, and I have lived in Dillingham and Bethel for most of my time here, but we're currently in Fairbanks, and that's where we'll stay. That's where our business is located.
I don't think any apologies are necessary. Most of us were not born here.
Well, some is accident of birth.
Go ahead, sir.
So I have some information here that at first may not look directly related to the low-altitude satellites. I know that there's a lot of interest in that, but there's some method to my madness, and I think I'll be able to tie this together for you a little bit. So on my introductory page, this is a depiction of the Jupiter 2 satellite, and this is going into service as we speak. It went up in December. Very rapidly was moved to its final orbital slot. An amazing satellite. The rocket itself weighed 1 million pounds with the satellite. It had 2 million pounds of thrust, and was in a supersynchronous orbit fairly quickly, moved to its final orbit. And within a month, the Hughes people were testing it. We are a tester for that, what we call Beam 139 in Fairbanks, and I can tell you that it's working beautifully and seems to me to have gone off without a hitch. Of course, I don't know everything that's happened in the background. Now, we should have with us today Mike Cook. He's Executive Vice President for Hughes. And Mike, are you with us?
I have Brian Ashton of HughesNet and Alan McCabe of HughesNet on the line for questions. I don't see anybody. Oh, I'm sorry. You're in the room. No,
I'm Will Johnson, and then Brian's down in Wrangell, and he like us is a dealer for HughesNet, and then I was expecting Mike Cook, but possibly Alan McCabe's on the line.
Alan McCabe is on the line for available for questions. Alan McCabe, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here, but so is our Executive Vice President, Mike Cook, and Mike will be the one answering the questions from Hughes.
Okay, great.
Okay,
Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you for being with us, Mike and Alan. These are two of my heroes in Hughes. They're very fine people. So I thought a little history might be interesting in how things circle back and give you a little background. I'll just try to cover this all real quickly, but I ran across some interesting information. And I remember this stuff. I'm old enough to remember this stuff. So Sputnik went up in 1957, Sputnik 1, and then Sputnik 2 went up and took a dog into space. And the dog died. The Russians said comfortable death, if there was such a thing, approximately 10 days. And turns out the dog probably cooked within a day or two. And then later they admitted that there had been a malfunction. So there was no hope for the dog from the beginning. It was a suicide mission. So then, and of course the Sputnik 2 was a larger, let's see now, what am I doing wrong here? Maybe if I click on this.
I was 5 years old when that happened. I really, I remember, you remember things when you're 5 years old.
So let's see, for some reason, there we go. I just have to choose the right key. So, anyway, this really shook us all up. I could even tell my parents were concerned, and so we were thinking about Russian satellites orbiting overhead, and we had to get our satellite up. So we launched Explorer 1 fairly quickly after Sputnik went up, and turns out it didn't do so well. Let's see, is that the one that went haywire on us? I might have got a couple of slides reversed here. Looks like, in fact, one's even missing. But at any rate, our first attempt failed, and then our second attempt went up. And notice how small these satellites were and what low power they were. And then in today's world, it seems like we're kind of circling back to that a little bit.
Wait, wait, hold on. At ease till we get our tech.
Okay, thank you. So anyway, we were very concerned because we had the Sputnik satellites going overhead, and you know, the Russians clearly had the jump on us. So very quickly though, we were ready with Vanguard TV3, and this satellite weighed 3 pounds. And the launch spectacularly failed. I think it got about 4 feet in the air, and something happened to the thrust, and it fell back to the ground and exploded. And just before it fell and burned up, the satellite itself was somehow propelled clear of the fire and explosion. And there you see it. It looks kind of damaged. It was too damaged to use again. But a very small satellite, not near as big as the Sputnik satellites. So then we put up Explorer 1. And Explorer 1 was successful, and so it was a real giant. It was 31 pounds, and had 60 watts of power, so quite a bit more power. And then we put up another Vanguard satellite, and that went up successfully. And I believe, if I recall correctly, the Vanguard satellite that's up now is still up. It's the longest satellite that's ever been in space, and I think it's projected to stay up about 240 years.
Wow. That original one that went up in 1958?
No, I believe it's this one here, the 10 milliwatt, 3.2 pound satellite. It's long since dead, but it's still circling up there.
Okay.
So I'd like to make a couple of quick definitions here. We have what we call LEOs, low Earth orbiting satellites, and these range between 100 and 1,240 miles up. And then we have our medium Earth orbit satellites, and they go from 240 to just below the GEO satellites. And I'll tell you about the GEO satellites in a moment. And of course, this is where we have our GPS, higher GPS satellites, and the what they call O3B, which is an interesting model which does not reach anywhere near Alaska. And then we have our geosynchronous satellites, and they're 22,300 miles up. And that's sometimes called the Clark Belt, named in honor of Arthur Clark, who was a British radar technician, instrumental in helping defeat the Germans in World War II. and he later became a science fiction writer. I used to read his books when I was a little kid because they seemed factual and true to the science rather than just pure fantasy. And then we've got the HEOs. These are highly elliptical orbits where the satellites go out incredibly far and then they come back fairly close to the Earth. So I want to mention a little bit about satellite phones because this ties into to what's coming. Certainly the early satellite phone network was Iridium. It was Motorola was behind it, and as and they went broke. It was sold off, and of course they had a good customer from the start, the military. They had 64 satellites. These satellites are getting really old and tired. They're working on replacements now. I think their first launch went up a little while back. And these 64, one of them was destroyed by a Russian satellite. There was a mid-air collision. And, of course, now we have this incredible amount of space junk floating out there from this mid-air collision. Mm-hmm. So on these satellites, you can text and phone. You have international phone numbers, which is kind of a nuisance for us. Real heavy voice compression makes it a little hard to understand. These relay, the signals relay from the ground to satellite to satellite to satellite back to the ground station again. They have some fairly reasonable plans. They have an Alaska plan that only works in Alaska. And it's $200 for 6 months, and you get 200 minutes to talk. And if you don't let your bill run out, then you're good for another, those minutes will accumulate, and you can go another 6 months. And supposedly it's available 24/7 everywhere. If you've actually used these very much, you realize that the truth is probably a little bit different than that.
Then the 200 minutes over 6 months? Or
you can use it for 6 months, then you have 200 minutes during that time period. So if you run out of the 200 minutes, you have to buy more.
Okay.
Then along came a competitor called Globalstar, and they got their constellation up, and very quickly these satellites failed in their voice function. Hmm. So they were nice and clear. They had an original constellation, which I'm really not talking about here. The current constellation is 24 satellites with some spares, which are mostly used up now. They could do some text, some voicemail, some really, really slow internet. And you get a local Wasilla number if you're using one here in Alaska, or you can get a number in a lot of other places. And what happens is the signal relays from the ground up to the satellite and then goes back directly back to the ground stations. And they have a program where you get free phones if you buy a certain size plan. One of their plans is unlimited use, unlimited minutes, $1,200 a year. Or they've got another plan, $780 for 1,200 minutes. And it works over most land maps, masses. There's some gaps in coverage toward the poles and especially this far north because the satellites aren't overhead all the time. You lose about 20 minutes out of every hour. So, but still, if you need a phone call, that's pretty darn nice, and the price is right. And again, these both the Iridiums and the Globalstars are low altitude satellites.
And these are currently available.
They're currently available. So this shows to me what's important about this is this shows that this stuff is possible. We're just going to go after it in a bigger way. So then, of course, we have a geosynchronous satellite phone, which is Inmarsat, and they have pretty clear audio. It doesn't work well near the poles, which is somewhat similar to Globalstar. Iridium's really the only one that's in a polar orbit and works well near the poles. And these earlier phones, you probably remember, were really expensive. I think they were $11 a minute to hook up and $10 a minute to talk, and you had to set up this laptop-looking thing and turn the lid towards the satellite. Of course, it had to be outdoors. Don't see many of those in Alaska much more. You would sometimes see them on boats and things mm-hmm. like that. So one of the interesting things that happened is Globalstar's sitting there with this nice company, all these satellites in orbit that don't work. And so they said, what the heck are we going to do now? We're dead. We're dead meat. We're going to go bankrupt. And they came up with the idea of the SPOT. And the SPOT's a locating device that's had enormous application here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. These folks were the folks that dreamed this idea up. And so they can, you can take one of these with you. And if you get lost, you can press an emergency button. People can see where you are. if you're in too bad a shape to press an emergency button, then you can the people back at home can actually look on a map and see exactly where you last were, where your device last reported in. And you can set up some pre-programmed messages. It's only one-way communication. You can set up a message that says you're okay, that sort of thing. These things are simple. They're cheap to buy, cheap to get an account for. They use lithium batteries. They don't seem to mind the cold too much. And but you don't have global coverage. They're weaker towards the poles because where the satellites are. The satellites are in an inclined orbit and only go to about 52 degrees north. But they are fairly high. They're about 1,000 miles up, so they do provide pretty decent coverage here in Alaska. By the way, the other one back there that I had was called a Trace, and that's just a gadget that works like a spot, except that it's intended for asset monitoring. So you can be really sneaky, put one of these under the hood of your snow machine, and then if somebody steals it, you can find out where it is. And there's been some thieves. It's got some ugly surprises where the owner knew where these were.
Mr. Johnson, you raised a quick question. You said the these only reach to 52 degrees north?
That's where the satellites go, but because they're so high, they reach
further.
They reach quite a bit
further. Okay, so Anchorage at 61 degrees north,
no problem.
Definitely.
They actually work very well in Anchorage, and of course, the further south you go, the better it works. Iridium's kind of the opposite with the polar orbit, but they seem to work better as you go north.
Interesting. Okay.
So
go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. Folks, do collect questions as we go along. I'll let Mr. Johnson give his presentation first, and then we'll take questions.
Now, there's another device that came along after Globalstar, and it's called SpiderTrax. I believe they're Australian-based, and so they track and can message, and they were intended for the aviation industry. So their device that's installed in an airplane, they use ship's power. They use the Iridium network, so they can work anywhere in the world because those are polar orbiting satellites. You can do some texting on them, depending on if you have the later devices or not. Of course, it's a fairly expensive product. But some of the airlines here in Alaska are using them, and it's wonderful to be able to see where those airplanes are.
Mm-hmm.
Then along came a company called InReach, and they kind of snuck in under the radar. They were, DeLorme is actually the name of the company, and DeLorme is a mapping company, and you've seen these big red books that have maps for every state, and of course we've got our Alaska mm-hmm. version, and it's kind of the Bible for maps if you need all the maps in a hurry. And they're fairly inexpensive to purchase, much cheaper than the SpiderTrax. They're a portable device. You have two-way communications with these, so you have texting and emailing both in both directions, in and out. They have an emergency button. They can show people at home where you are on a map. They have pre-programmed messages also, but you can do your custom messages, of course. And plans are reasonable price. I think the cheapest plan is about $15 a month. And they have a rechargeable battery that just uses a cell phone type charger, and they're good for several days when they're recharged, and they seem to work real well in the cold. Not to waste all your time, but as a side note, I used one of these devices when I had an engine failure, went down in the trees, and I was able to very quickly send a message out because I knew my wife, and I knew that the people watching me with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who I was working for at the time, would be worried. They'd see everything's going along just fine, and all of a sudden everything stops. So I sent a little message out, engine failure, all okay. Of course, I was okay, but the airplane wasn't okay. Then I used my satellite phone, which I had one of those global satellite phones, and I arranged my rescue. So this stuff is real valuable. Not long after that happened, there was some people went down, and it took them 11 days to be found, and they were trying to walk, and they were still 3 days from help. I'm going to guess they're carrying one of these devices these days. I wanted to mention some general challenges here for Alaska. It's very, very challenging for providers. Certainly the people that provide terrestrial services, satellite services. And by the way, I kind of see for Alaska a mix of these technologies to really adequately cover the state. So, of course, anytime we're dealing with satellite, we have logistics issues, as does everybody else for everything we do, shipping costs, installer travel issues. We have an incredibly large area to cover. Try to think of the lower 48 from the East Coast back to about the Mississippi River. That's what we're trying to cover. And yet we have as many customers potentially as a small city in the lower 48. So the economics really sneak in here in a hurry. I wanted to mention the FCC requires certified installers. We use a little bit different business model where we partner with people in the bush, and then we use them to install equipment rather than having people needing to travel out from town. And, of course, our ground is always moving, so it's hard to make sure that antennas stay pointed right. That requires attention. That's when it's nice to have these local people in the bush. We have cold temperatures. That's hard on electronics. Some electronics don't like to work in the cold. And, of course, high winds, and that moves the antennas around and things like that. And then we have things like coax cables get ate by certain little animals. Other day, I had a lady call me up, all bent out of shape because her satellite wasn't working. And turns out her husband had emptied the ashes next to the house. It's a wonder she didn't burn the house down. And right there was where the cable went into the ground to go out to where the satellite dish was. So it burned through the cable. just things like that. So sometimes our off-grid power is a little bit unstable, particularly alternative energy, and sometimes even the village power isn't terribly stable, and that's hard on our electronics. Our satellites are all over the equator, so even in the very best case where we have a satellite that's due south of us, it's still pretty darn low to the horizon, and the further north you go, the worse that problem gets. And of course, I mentioned the O3B network, which is a very interesting model. I won't waste your time with it, but it doesn't come anywhere near here. In fact, it barely reaches the northern border of the lower 48. Also, I might mention that sometimes TV dealers bundle with the satellite internet providers, and here in the state, our satellite internet providers are Exceed and Hughes for consumers. So going back to kind of our first satellite internet for consumers in the state was Starband. It no longer operates here. They were the recipient of around $19 million to install satellite systems. Basically, no sooner got the $19 million used, they pulled the plug on their network, and all that money kind of went to waste. Quite a bit of money. The only good news is several of us as dealers have salvaged the antennas and used them to establish communications with Exceed and with, which is Viasat's, the parent company of Exceed, and then Hughes. So some of these antennas have been recovered and reused. And they've had a tough life. They've had, they went through bankruptcy. I think they were close to going through bankruptcy again. Their satellite failed right after their first bankruptcy, so that didn't do them any good. And I actually felt sorry for them just because of all the trouble. And I worked with their product for many years, too. So what we have right now over the entire state of Alaska, except the Aleutians and Pribilofs, is the Hughes Gen 2 product. This is an older legacy product. By today's standards, it's pretty slow. When we first started putting this stuff in here in Alaska 10, 11, 12 years ago, it was the best thing out there for many, many people, and in many cases, the only thing out there. So it was the first product where we used, where it was two-way. We used the satellite to return the signals back to the internet. So originally, we broadcast down by satellite, and we used telephone lines to get back up again, which actually worked pretty darn good when you think about how that could work. So we started operating with a satellite called Horizons 1 in about 2004, and this satellite is still going strong. I recently heard from one of the specialists that deals with satellites at Hughes that they're expecting this to operate through 2023. It's relatively high in the sky as satellites go, as geosynchronous satellites go. It's KU band. It uses what we call bent pipe construction, which basically it says it's a reflector or a mirror. So whatever comes up from the ground, it just sends back to the ground, and that works both directions. We have a couple of network operation centers that serve Alaska. One's in Germantown, Maryland, and the others in Las Vegas. Las Vegas it has an advantage of not having so many rainstorms. If you ever go to Germantown, it's just this incredibly beautiful area, and it seems like it rains a lot. And it's so green, it's almost like a rainforest there. But that's a little bit hard on satellite signals sometimes. So Las Vegas almost never have a problem. Consumer speeds, we get up to 2 megabits per second. Prices range from $60 to $200 a month. We have some usage limits, but interestingly enough, it's unlimited at night. There's a nighttime period where it's unlimited, and a lot of times the folks in the villages, they'll stay up late and really enjoy that unlimited nighttime use. And that's one of the things that people are always asking for. They're not necessarily asking for more speed. They want unlimited. So, of course, the faster the speed, the more you can use. Normal size antennas, 0.74 meter, that's about a 2.5-foot dish. I kind of like those because the wind doesn't catch them so much. And then we have a larger 0.98 meter, and we have even installed some larger ones yet. 0.98 meters, about 39 inches. We sometimes put up a 4-foot dish. And so the only people that can't get fist satellites past the end of the peninsula and then the Pribilof Islands. This is a picture of the coverage of this particular satellite. You can see that it covers the lower 48. It's really the only satellite I can think of now that does this amazing job of covering virtually the entire U.S.,
wow,
even Hawaii. And so you can see that it has a real strong signal kind of in the east central part of the lower 48, and nearly as strong a signal over almost half of Alaska. And even when you start getting out in the fringe areas that it covers, it's still a tremendously strong signal. So it's been a wonderful satellite, just an older technology. And of course, I've been very grateful that Hughes continues to support this satellite, because for a large part of the state, it's all we have. And you may say, well, gee, this is kind of old and slow and clunky, but let me tell you, it beats Morse code and smoke signals and tin cans and strings. So another product that's come into Alaska is the Exceed satellite by Viasat. I'm going to ask the Hughes people to put their fingers in their sensitive ears while I mention Exceed, but it's been a good product for us. It's a satellite where it went up and is similar to our second Ka-band spot beam. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Ka-band spot beam in a minute and how this has improved our life in the satellite industry. It's in a relatively good position for Alaska. It's at 115 degrees west over the equator. This puts it sort of more or less south of San Diego over the equator. So it's fairly decent height in the sky as Alaska goes. There's a band of coverage that I'll show you in a minute that goes from Prince William Sound up to about Kotzebue. And it has relatively good performance compared to KU services. Their current speeds are 12 megabits per second down and 3 megabits per second upload. And the prices range from $60 to $150 a month in that range. They're about to have a speed increase to 25 megabits per second download, which you might note is the minimum speed that the FCC came out in a broadband report of 2015 to be considered broadband. And, of course, that number keeps creeping up, and the day will come, of course, we'll look at 25 megabits per second and say, gee whiz, that's sure clunky and slow. And I suspect that we're going to see the day come before terribly long where we'll look at 100 megabits per second as what we need to call it broadband. But Exceed will soon have a 25 megabit per second download. Right now they're 3 megabits per second up. I don't know if that's going to change or not. Relatively easy to install and service, but we do need certified installers. And the short story is why there's certification. All the satellite guys, particularly the internet guys, require certification because there's a very real chance that you can damage the performance of the satellite, actually make it work poor by a customer that's not conforming to the standards of how they should be installed. And, of course, we get people all the time that say, gee, I installed my brother-in-law's Dish TV 5 years ago. I don't need no blankety-blank installer to put in my system. And it just doesn't work that way in today's world. So we use 0.74-meter antenna in the Exceed beam. There's been some work to use this product outside the beam, 1.2-meter antenna and even a 1.8-meter antenna. I happen to have a 1.8-meter antenna, and I'm picking it up 100 miles outside the beam. It's kind of crummy that outside the beam that far, but at least it does work. I had to coat the antenna with tinfoil to get it to work right. So I used a special glue so I could get the tinfoil off. It's called Cairo SERP. Okay, right here is the spot beam. Now, spot beams, you might think, well, gee, that looks kind of like a flashlight shining on the surface of the Earth, but because this is coming up from so far south and east, it's elongated. It's spread out into kind of an elliptical shape. And there's some other considerations, which is why you don't see the rest of the elliptical part of it, but basically from Prince William Sound out to Kotzebue. And we do get outside that beam area just a little bit. So Hughes just launched our Gen 5 satellite, and this is, you notice we skipped some generations here. So we've been a little bit behind, and now all of a sudden we're catching up with the rest of the world. So it's the most powerful broadband satellite ever launched to date, and we're going to have a speed to start out with. I know this satellite's capable of a lot, but right now it's set at 25 megabits per second download, 3 megabits per second upload, consumer pricing ranging between 50 and 130 a month. And I think we're going to see a lot of people go with that $50 price, because what happens on satellite, if you go over on your usage, you don't get charged more. They just slow you down. But this thing is so darn fast that even when it's slowed down, I'm thinking most people won't notice it. We've even heard reports of that on the Exceed satellite, that it's fast enough that when people get slowed down, they won't notice it. And Hughes is telling us we'll be able to continue to do video even after we get slowed down, and I believe it.
Mr. Johnson, just a moment. Our next speaker is already on the line, so
okay.
Just a few more minutes. But I see you have lots of diagrams to show us, so let's,
yeah. Okay.
Let's
so, go. This will go pretty quick now.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have here a picture of what the spot beams are like. You can think cell phones. Basically, instead of spreading the signal all over the country, localized in localized areas, and the horsepower is directed into localized areas. This saves power, and it saves frequency spectrum, which is always valuable. Here's a picture of the spot beams in Alaska. This is the one for southeast that I'm focused on here, and you'll be pleased to see that it covers the whole southeast part of the country. This is the one that we're going to have in kind of the mainland part of Alaska, the eastern side, and so it'll cover all the way clear down through Homer, most of Lake Clark, and clear up through the Fairbanks area, down towards Northway, up towards Rampart. We also have some enterprise services. This is KU-band. This is where we could help with schools and libraries, and have helped where they're out beyond the reach of fiber and that sort of thing. That's the advantage of satellite, that we can get to places where you don't have cable or can't get permits to run across the tundra and things like that. We have low contention ratios. That means that there's a lot more horsepower and a lot less bandwidth for these satellites. More expensive equipment, of course. Larger antennas, a little more difficult to transport and install. Speeds are up to 5 megabits per second. Services can range from 300 to 3,000 a month. We have unlimited plans available, sometimes at extra cost. And, of course, there's some specialized options you can get that you wouldn't get with KU consumer services, or even KA. So we have various enterprise service providers. Hughes, a Canadian company called Switch, another Canadian company called Galaxy. They haven't really done much in this state. iDirect, you see quite a bit of that. Exceed has some business services. Starband still is in the state under new ownership. They're serving the post offices. Another company called Network Innovations has suggested they're interested in Alaska. So what's coming? Well, we've got some really neat antennas that are coming, flat plate antennas that are not like a dish. They can automatically point to the satellite. What Hughes envisions is the low altitude satellites, which you're interested in, and the geosynchronous satellites working together. The beauty of the low altitude satellites is you have low latency. And so a lot of people complain about latency on satellite, but the main thing that it affects is gaming and also your remote desktop type operations, VPN. So Hughes envisions where the low latency applications would go on the low altitude satellites, and then the geo satellites, geosynchronous satellites, would work for the heavy lifting. And so this gives you the best of both worlds. Every customer would have two kind of satellites.
Yeah, I have just a clarifying question. Could you describe what low latency means?
Well, the speed of light, you know, is a finite number. And so when we go into outer space and back, we have time delay. So certainly latency or that time delay and the speed of the connection mix together in your perception. But if you have a faster speed, that tends to cancel out your perception of slowness if you have high latency. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the worst case is high latency and low speed. So some connections are a little slower, but if they have a low latency, that seems to make them not feel quite so bad.
So it's the time delay of the information.
Yeah, and that round trip time is around a half a second. It can be as much as 3/4 of a second if you when you consider the electronic delays and various other things that has to happen.
Got it. Circuitry. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Johnson, I see we're almost at the end, and I'm going to ask to hold questions. Committee, okay? We have two more presentations and not quite enough time to do them both, so.
Okay. Well, now, we do have these folks from Hughes that were here to help answer any questions. They're on the line right now. Do you have any questions you can think of at this moment?
Any burning questions that can't wait? All right. Folks from Hughes can stay on the line for questions towards the end, if they come up, we would appreciate it. Any comments to offer from the folks online? Okay, Mr. Johnson, go ahead and wrap it up.
Okay, so there's been some concerns, can this really work? Can these low-altitude satellites really work? Well, we know they work with the satellite phones. This is just going to be an extension of what's already been done with the satellite phones. These satellite phones carry data and voice right now. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be many, many times as big, many more satellites. There's three competing projects out there. Hughes is a big part of one. When you look at the money behind this stuff and you look at the horsepower, the incredibly powerful people that's involved in this sort of thing, including Bezos with Amazon and Musk and Hughes and Coca-Cola, there's some big money behind this. I have every confidence that they're going to succeed with this. Are there challenges? Absolutely. But I think as early as 2018, we're going to start, that's next year, we're going to start to see this stuff happening. So these satellites will be mass-produced. We're not going to have the enormous cost that you have in building satellites now, because they'll build a bunch of them. They'll all be alike. Instead of being mostly what we have today are more or less custom satellites. I even asked the question, could Alaska be a good place to launch from? Because we're not going into outer space, and we're and the further north you go, the better the launch for these kind of polar satellites. We're looking at the possibility of cell phones that are satellite-enabled and cost as little as $10 a month, I've heard about.
Wouldn't that be nice?
So there's a picture of a flat plate antenna. It doesn't have to be moved to point. It's not like a dish you have to point. It just electronically can point anywhere you want it to. That's in an aircraft. This is another one that's mounted on a Toyota automobile. That's so we can drive around and text easier. And then this is a...
Isn't that illegal?
This is a little diagram of some of these low-altitude satellites and the different projects that are involved there. So that's all I have. I certainly hope we can take a little advantage of Mr. Cook and Mr. McCabe, because these are some really top people if you ever want to ask some good questions.
All right. This was a really excellent presentation. Thank you. You have renewed my faith. Let's gather questions. Let the other two presenters go and get started, and we'll go from there. All right?
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Sure, we'll be able to get back.
Okay.
Mr. Cooper.
Well, I understand. Okay, I'd like to take note that Representative Westlake joined us at just before 9 a.m. And Christina Wilson, are you on the line with us?
I am.
All right, put your name on the record and your affiliation, and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chairman Drummond. My name is Christina Wilson, and I am the Vice President of External Relations for Quintillion. And as a point of clarification, how long would you like me to keep this to?
I believe we originally gave you a half an hour, but we're down to 45 minutes for two presentations, so talk fast.
You bet. I sent over a slide deck, a PDF, so if you'd like to follow along, I'm going to go immediately into slide two, the Meet Quintillion slide. As I mentioned, my name is Christina Wolfson. I'm originally from the community of Mathnick in Bristol Bay, and certainly a product of our rural communities and the need for telecommunications in the terminal areas. Quintillion as a company is headquartered in Anchorage. We're a privately funded company. Our project is privately funded, which includes select Alaska investors such as ASRC, Trista is a partner, and also Aztec on the northern part of Alaska. We are building and will operate a multi-phase fiber optic cable network that is anchored in and around Alaska that has plans to connect to Asia, Arctic, Canada, and Europe, and I'll talk about that a little bit to the map in a moment. We're a private operator selling wholesale capacity on our system, so we like to say that we're carrier agnostic. We provide the opportunity to purchase capacity on our system, and we have kept this system as a wholesale network to encourage competition, to encourage multiple providers and communities. We deliver capacity on our system at 50 to 90% price reductions over current backhaul options of microwave and satellite. And the system's first segment will be in service, is scheduled to be in service in 2017, and I'll talk about that to the map. If you would move to slide three, please. The Quintillion subsea cable system is three phases, and phase one is almost complete, and as I mentioned, is on schedule to be in service in 2017. Phase two is to extend the network to west to Asia from the known branching unit, and the intent here is to create a diverse path of communications out of Alaska by fiber. The phase three section would extend east from the Prudhoe Bay branching unit, and it would go, travel through the Lower Northwest Passage with plan spurs into northern Arctic Canadian communities, as well as to extend over to Europe. And at that point, it would be a shorter route between European and Asian markets. But I would like to point out that each phase is financially independent and financially viable all on its own. We've designed the system to be a trunk and branch configuration. If you would please move on to slide four, this is a better view of the Alaska system. The trunk and branch configuration at the subsea means that each independent branch into a community, so the communities of Nome, Kotzebue, Point Hope, Wainwright, Barrow, and into Prudhoe Bay, are all independent of each other. So it's not a daisy chain like you see sometimes in other systems. The phase one system is initially anchored by a terrestrial system that we have built between Fairbanks and Prudhoe Bay Dead Horse area. A couple of years ago, we purchased the infield fiber system with Alaska Communication System as part of the Prudhoe Bay Dead Horse fiber system, but the fiber that will connect at Fairbanks to connect to the World Wide Web, the rest of the internet, is initially anchored to our terrestrial system. In 2016, we got almost everything done. We need to go back and do a little bit of work this year off of the Prudhoe Bay branch where it goes subsea at Olaktok Point off of the North Slope. And that is for the purposes of the long-term resiliency and risk mitigation for our system because it is an active ice scour region, which I'll address in slides in just a minute. Before I proceed off of this map, I would like to point out that this is what we see as the beginning of Quintillion system in Alaska. We hope to announce later this year additional locations in Alaska where we plan to bring fiber off of our system as it stands right now on this map.
Great. Okay.
If you would move to, you can move right to slide six. And when I talked about our 50 to 90% reduction in backhaul prices over satellite and microwave, when you look at rural communications, and we understand, because there's not a lot of fiber in Alaska, that it is sometimes a challenge to bring fiber to different places. But where we can bring fiber, we believe that we should. It's the best backhaul option. And in terms of our communities, a virtually unlimited capacity. our system is designed to have three fiber pairs on the subsea with 10 million megabits per second per fiber pair, and we can triple that capacity by changing out the equipment in our community-based landing site locations. And with three fiber pairs, that's a 30 terabit per second system of capacity. The cost of construction initially is a little higher with fiber to install, but the cost of construction is coming down. And we're the first company to do this in the area where we're installing right now in Arctic Alaska, Arctic North America. And so certainly lessons learned will be passed along and will be experienced through our experiences of installing fiber in the North American Arctic. The low cost of operations and maintenance is what really drives the cost down for fiber. When we look at the design and installation plan of our system, it's intended to install it and for the next, you know, few decades to not touch it again, really. I mean, we have taken great care with the design and installation and construction of our fiber system in the hopes and the plan that we do not have to touch it. And that's the difference between the operations and maintenance in terms of fiber and microwave. And then also the limited capacity. But our system is complementary to existing infrastructure, and we are excited about what the backhaul on our fiber system can mean for existing infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure in rural Alaska. Moving on to page 7, I don't need to explain this to you. I think that everybody understands what the opportunities and possibilities are on fiber. Education, of course, is at the top of the list, and digital classrooms, smart classrooms, and allowing teachers to take advantage of what my alma mater provides, digital college courses at a pretty low rate to remote communities. So this is an exciting opportunity. So I'm going to let you absorb that slide on your own, but I think it really speaks for itself, the possibilities with unlimited capacity and pretty significant speeds on our system. I think it's important to point out how we have designed and built our subsea cable system because of where we're at. So if you move to slide 9, we are not the first company to be associated with an Arctic or an Arctic Ocean fiber optic cable system. You may have heard about a company called Arctic Fiber based out of Canada. And when the investors funded the system, they selected Quintillion to be the company that would build and operate the system. So it's an Anchorage-based company, which is very exciting for Alaska. And so we acquired the assets of Arctic Fiber, and so we are the company that will build and operate the system. As I mentioned, it's a phased approach. It's taken us about 4.5 years to design and install a system right now that's both logical and feasible. And I forgot to mention on a slide earlier that we have installed and the system into the Dead Horse Market is scheduled to be in service in about 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, and that's very exciting because it does anchor the subsea system. The construction and installation of the system into Barrow, Point Hope, Wainwright, Kotzebue, and Nome is virtually complete. We have a very small segment to achieve deeper burial, like I have mentioned, but we're able to monitor and watch the system over the course of this entire winter, which is important for the risk factors that I'll talk about in just a moment. Page 10 on the slide, we designed, part of the risk mitigation is to horizontal directionally drill and board each cable landing community. So we start from the shore side and we went down about 60 to 80 feet and we went out in some places a mile in steel conduit and an HDD bore in order to protect the cable but also to minimize shoreline disruption. Of course, coastal erosion is a consideration in our communities and we want to leave the least impact possible. In the communities where fiber is run, that's also buried and in conduit. And then the construction of the cable itself is high quality glass where the light waves pass through and then everything else is designed to protect the fiber itself. We've used a lot of Alaska companies to install the system. New Horizons is one, RTKC, Alaska Directional Drilling, Fairweather, So a lot of opportunities in Alaska for local companies to be a part of the project. And we chose Alcatel Submarine Networks as our design, build, and construction company because of their success rate with their repeaters, which are important to boost the signal of the system. As the gentleman before me mentioned, of course, latency is a consideration, and we help to mitigate latency by the repeaters in the system that boost the signal. If you go to page 11, this is just a diagram of our fiber. As I mentioned, the high-quality fiber optic strands are in the middle, and then everything else is meant to protect it. In many areas along the cable route, we have it double reinforced. In some areas, it's single reinforced, and in other areas, it's in conduit, as I had mentioned. Page 12 talks to the significant investment in time and planning, over 2 years of marine surveys. The geotechnical and geophysical studies really tell us what is the risk factor along the cable route. And in Nome, it's things like gold dredges. In off the coast of Barrow Point, Hope Wayne, right into Prudhoe Bay, it's really that ice gallon and ice sherm that I had mentioned. So the design is all around mitigating that risk. And the thing that's important is it has been a significant amount of time in invested in permits, approvals, and easements. And we were the first ones to accomplish this, to truly go after this type of installation system in the area where we're at. And they had only had a process for oil and gas companies. And so we had to follow many of the same processes as oil and gas companies because they did not have the history of permitting a fiber optic company in that particular part of the state. If you go to page 13, I mentioned the risk that we have to address, and then the mitigation plan. And historically around the world, it's human interaction that's the biggest risk to subsea cable systems. In Alaska, the biggest risk is the ice gouging. And they call it kind of the mixing bowl off of the North Slope there, where ice that breaks that bumps along the seafloor, and it can gouge into the seabed. And so we've designed a system, and our mapping and surveying showed us all the historical data. We can't tell if it's 10 years old or 10,000 years old, though. So we have designed a system to bury the cable deeper than any historical ice gouging. So we feel that that's a good risk mitigation plan to avoid any future ice gouging. We have dual redundant network equipment, and we have a really strong operations and maintenance, and we have the ability to effect repair if necessary. If you look at page 14, that's a picture of one of our repeaters being laid off of the coast of Alaska this past summer. There were 13 vessels in the water at any given time in 2016, and this is one of the stern end of the Elder Brayhot, which is a purpose-built cable vessel that we had brought to Alaska. There were two of them in Alaska. Slide 15 is one of the plows that trenches along the seafloor, and the cable falls into the trench behind the plow, and then it goes in behind it to cover the trench. And that's the, you can see a portion of the Elder Sun, another one of the cable vessels that came to Alaska. Page 16, we do not use ice class vessels. We do not use icebreakers. We use ice managers, and so tugs to gently move the ice away from where we are laying the cable. But as you can see, installing fiber in the Arctic is what you can imagine. There's ice, and there's a lot of activity up there. Slide 17 again, the Norman O support vessel nudging ice away from one of the cable-laying vessels. And then slide 18 is when our vessels farther offshore, sitting amongst the ice, waiting for it to move away. And then the final slide is just one of additional photo of our slot of our cable-laying ships off the coast of Barrow. And at that point, I'm able to answer any questions. I apologize. It was a very fast presentation. I'm available for additional questions if we don't have the time today. It's a lot of information, and I just would like to reiterate that we're very excited to come into service into the Prudhoe Bay Dead Horse market in you know, next month, and then later this year into the subsea communities of Barrow Point, Hope, Wainwright, Cotterview, and Nome.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wilson. You did an excellent job. You're almost exactly on time. I understand that you also stepped out of a board meeting to speak with us today, and I am so thankful. I'm so thankful for that. Are there any questions from the committee? We'll start with Mr. Fansler.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for your presentation through the chair. I did have a couple of questions. So essentially what I'm hearing from the Quintillion Project is that essentially you're going to be setting up the infrastructure for this, and then you'll be selling or leasing the capacity to other providers. Is that correct?
That's correct. We are not a telecommunications services provider to the end user or the consumer. We sell to telecommunications providers, and then they offer products, pricing, services to institutions and individual users.
Okay. And can you just speak to just a slight bit about the capacity of these systems? I know that you kind of mentioned that they have a large-scale capacity. It does look like eventually when you get through all three phases, you're going to be tying in, multiple continents. Is there a point where it reaches its max capacity, or is there, pipeline for all, really?
We believe that there is unlimited capacity for the Alaska market, and it's a three-pair system, so each pair initially operates at 100 gigabits per second at 100 waves per fiber pair, which is about 30 terabits per second. So the way that, I can absorb that information in real terms is it's about 2,500 high-definition movies downloaded in a second. And so we believe that the systems into our communities will not reach the capacity limits that sometimes currently constrain our communities.
Did you say 2,500 high-def movies downloaded in 1 second?
I did.
Thank you. I'm shocked. Go ahead, Mr.
Follow up more of a comment, but I want to once again thank you for your presentation. I know that my office has spoken with you multiple times about this project. We're very, very keen to see if when you do expand, we would love you to certainly try to expand further south into western Alaska with your hub. So thank you very much for all of your help with this, and we appreciate it.
Excellent. Any further questions?
Thank you very much, Representative Danfer.
Any further questions for Ms. Wilson?
Just a comment, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kopp, go ahead.
Yes, Christina, this is the most exciting telecom project that we've had before the committee this year, and thank you for your excellent presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kopp.
Thank you.
Representative Sponholz, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wilson, you mentioned phase one construction is underway and scheduled to be in service this year. What quarter do you expect to be online with phase one?
We expect to be online fourth quarter of this year. We are. We have to wait for the ice to leave in order for us to affect the construction finalization off the north coast of Alaska. So we won't be able to begin construction until probably the August timeframe when the ice leaves the shore. And so that leaves us, a couple of months, and then we have to do the confidence testing in order for Quintillion to, what they say, commission or receive the system and then turn it over to service providers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. Any further questions? If not, thank you so much, Ms. Wilson. This has been absolutely fascinating. I'm going to call up, Paul Bardos, principal of Star of the Northwest Magnet School. Mr. Bardos, thank you so much for coming to join us today. Put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
My name is Paul Bartos. I'm principal of Star of the Northwest. I am employed by the Northwest Artboro School District. First of all, Madam Chair and fellow representatives, thank you for this opportunity. Today I will be speaking about Star of the Northwest and how technology is used on a boots-on-the-ground scenario. And I do have a presentation slideshow.
We have that presentation, so go ahead, Mr. Bartos.
They have a copy of it.
Okay.
He needs a copy.
Okay. We need an at ease. Okay. Quick. Back on the record, the presentations are online. We're having technical difficulties, so you won't see them on the screens. But they're on basis, folks who are listening in. And Mr. Bartos, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today I'll be speaking about the structure of entities, student offerings, student supports, technology uses, and how to improve it. And finally, where we have been and where we'll be headed in the future. Once again, thank you all. We, on that first slide, we are located above the Arctic Circle at Kotzebue. Kotzebue is the hub community for the Northwest Alaska region. STAR, at the end of this month, will complete its second full year of operations. It is a full-time boarding school for high school students for Alaska students. STAR primarily focuses on 11th and 12th grade students. The next slide. Speaking to what makes up STAR to support students, first, the University of Alaska. Through the University of Alaska system, we provide students dual enrollment. Secondly, Alaska Technical Center. Our high school students take courses through the Alaska Technical Center and Kotzebue High School. The first usage I can offer you is that Kotzebue High School is our 1A basketball tournament. As we know, basketball is very important to all of our communities. We Ustream all those games through Kotzebue back out to the villages. It's just basically YouTube on our homepage, and that takes up a lot of internet usage, but we still manage our daily operations for students and provide that to all community members through the region. And finally, our last entity to support STAR the Northwest is the district itself. We call on and rely on teachers throughout the whole region to provide instruction to students through video teleconferencing. If an educator is strong, for example, in the education field, they will provide instruction through the video teleconferencing for 30 students right now district-wide. And on the other side of that, those are our supports, and here's what we offer our students. Full-time enrollment. Looking at that slide, we have students, 9 of our 12 graduates are going on to higher education. Yes, ma'am. 9 of our 12 students, instead of going into career readiness right now, our students are finding confidence of, like I said, going on to University of Fairbanks and Anchorage. Our Ready Start programs are 2-week intensive courses. The same things offered to the Ready Start intensive kids are offered to our full-time students. We provide exposure and focus for those students. We just had a student 2 months ago for technology who was deaf, and we provided an iPad and an interpreter. That interpreter was with that student the whole entire time, so that student was allowed the same opportunities as another 2-week Ready Start student. So that was a very nice use of our technology. And the dorm. To reiterate this, we're in 2.5 years in production and operation of the dorm. We utilize that year-round. For example, we have set up a summer program with the ANSEP folks. They will be coming to Kotzebue for 6th grade students to participate in a short course with them. Furthermore, we offer a C3 camp for first year teachers new to the region. They stay at our dorm as well. That's a highly effective program. Next, our pillars on the next slide. Our pillars, we offer it in, We offer 4 different pillars: education, process tech, culinary arts,
process, and healthcare. Excuse me, give me a sec. I'll back up with all of you.
It seems to be on this page.
Yes.
But it's all not
yep.
One thing that popped up after another.
We offer those four pillars due to the high demand, high paying jobs mm-hmm. that they offer. Our opportunities, we have partnerships. One, for example, the U.S. Coast Guard to show our students unique job placements in the future. Beyond the opportunities, we have the certifications. For example, students in the two-week programs come in for culinary arts. They can receive their ServSafe food handler. These students use these certifications for summertime employment. It is imperative for me and for me to remain focused on this is relevancy. Why students come to school, the motivation to attend, the motivation to do well, and what's in it for the students at the end. The reason why I bring that up is our education pillar. As everyone knows, there's a lack of teachers statewide. We have teamed up with the Future Educators of Alaska. We have the largest group attending the conference right now in Anchorage. Our students are competing with 15 of them there. And this ties back into the technology. Our district will be using our video teleconferencing. We'll be offering our courses, three different courses statewide, beginning this fall. We already have interest from CHEVAC. I just spoke to them 2 days ago to start participating in that this fall. And finally on that slide, experience. We want our students to experience the latest curriculum with the latest technology with customized schedules. One example of that customized schedule, we have two students who have just finished the Millwright program before they have graduated, and they will be headed to Red Dog Mine. So we're very excited for those two students from Kivalina. Our instructors, we are very fortunate to have instructors who have the industry qualified, certificated individuals working and supporting our students. How we use the internet. It's very interesting for us in the Northwest Arctic Borough. Our Power School is our interface, our day-to-day operations, student attendance, student academics, etc. We utilize that technology so it's not compromised. When I mean that, there's students cannot get onto online curriculum for that. If we have any latency in our PowerSchool operating system, students wouldn't be able to take attendance, put in grades, they would be stalled out. So with that, it is important that we have utilized certain sections of our internet to maintain our operating status. For students, our students use Canvas learning systems for our students. Our students can go back to the dorm, look at their assignments, speak to their instructors, submit assignments, have interface amongst one another, and so they're learning even not in the classroom. Finally, we provide the same services as urban districts with 0.015% of the internet strength. We do this by filtering students, our firewalls, etc. Our students right now are provided 69 kilobytes. The goal for this is 100. In order to do this, the district will have to take an increase of $160,000 a month increase in order to provide this service to our students. And finally, here at the very end, goals, I would like to talk about the goals for the Mainer School. As you can see, on the fiscal year 16, we had 8 full-time students, and I just marked one application there, but it was actually 0 at this time. If we take a look, currently this week, I have 20 applications for full-time status and 25 full-time students. So we are growing, we are learning, and I'm very proud to be part of this.
All right. Is that the end of your presentation?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Bartos, excellent. I just want to make note, before we go to questions for Mr. Bartos, the folks from HughesNet are still online and did want to make a very brief presentation to us, simply verbally. So if the folks from HughesNet can hear me, please stay on the line with us. All right? Okay.
This is Brian Ashton. Ellen, are you online?
Did we have questions for you? Hold on a second, HughesNet folks. We have questions for the presenter from the Star of the North Magnet School in front of us, and as soon as we're done, then we will get to you. Okay? Just checking that you're still online. Thank you. Okay. Questions for Mr. Bartos. Mr. Parrish, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I remember my Quintilian map correctly, you're going to be on, or at least very close. No, you'll be on the fiber network. What do you anticipate in the change of your available speed and cost?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, it is my understanding right now, Kotzebue does not have the same internet speed, for example, as Kobuk does upriver from us. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is both sites, you know, we think Kotzebue would be on top of the technology, but with the same amount of strength, both sites, well, there's more students in Kotzebue, so that's slowing us down while it's speeding Kobuk up. Mm-hmm. With this new connection, it's going to equal the internet usage for our students, so it'll speed us up.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Additional questions for Mr. Bartos?
I can do it offline.
Okay.
Yeah, just a comment, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Mr.
Bartos. It's amazing what the Magnet School is doing there in Kotzebue, and possibly also, and just compliments to you in your work there in this whole presentation. Do you think the possibility of a federal partnership with communications, should the Coast Guard expand operations there, brings in some new possibilities for the district?
Through the chair, I'm sorry, are you finished, sir? Through the chair, Representative Kopp, it's interesting you say that. We are looking at expanding and growing to meet the needs of the region and meet the needs of the students. We had the four pillars, but the fifth pillar we're pursuing right now is transportation, maritime, Coast Guard, aviation. Yes, we are going that direction with the Coast Guard.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Just a quick question. You are partnering with the university system. Do you see at some point where you will be so much of a partner that you'll be working, that you'll become one entity with, I forgot the name of the college.
Chukchi.
Where you'll become one as opposed to two completely separate entities.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I think that is a question for my direct supervisor, to tell you the truth.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions for Mr. Bartos? I just saw this piece of your presentation where it says that $164,000 per month is needed to bring the Northwest Arctic Borough School District up to the FCC 2014 short-term goal.
Yes, ma'am.
And I assume that they are not currently spending that much money per month.
Madam Chair, I can give you that information.
Okay.
What we can spend per month.
Okay,
what we're spending
you
right now.
All right. Very good. All right. Seeing no additional questions, thank you so much for coming and presenting to us. If there are any additional questions pop up, we'll get connected. And
I apologize about the technical issues.
That's okay. All right. Okay. Back to the folks who are waiting patiently on the phone with us from HughesNet. If you could introduce yourselves and your affiliation and go ahead and give us a brief presentation. We have approximately 9 minutes.
This is Brian Ashton. Alan, are you online?
Looks like he just dropped off.
Okay. if he comes back online, if you'd interrupt me, because he would be much more capable to speak to the potential for what HughesNet can do for Alaska in the future.
Yeah.
My name is Brian Ashton. I'm from Wrangell, Alaska. I helped introduce HughesNet into the state about 10 years ago. And as Will had basically been over the history of satellites so people could get a perspective of where satellite has come and where it is today, and then in relation to where it can go tomorrow for Alaska. This new satellite that's being lit up literally within the last couple days and then the next week in Alaska is the most powerful satellite internet in the world. And although we got two spot beams for covering portions of Alaska, in this case, all of southeast Alaska up through Yakutat, and then a modified spot beam that covers some of the area of central Alaska. As you're aware, there's a lot of areas in rural Alaska, especially the more remote regions, that the satellite could not hit because it's not far enough west. What sparked my interest in calling in today was that HughesNet is planning on launching more satellites perpetually about every 3 years. And with the amount of money that I read in the Alaska report from the FCC, the significant amount of funding that they're going to be pumping into Alaska to get a baseline of 10 megabytes a second download to these communities, the fact that HughesNet's most current satellite guarantees a minimum of 25 megabytes a second, which is 2.5 times what the 10-year plan for the FCC wants to hit, with, I think it's $2.4 billion over 10 years. In talking to HughesNet Corporate yesterday, they basically said, well, Brian, we could launch 5 satellites for that amount of money. Technically, for 20% of that funding, we could launch a brand new satellite just as powerful as Jupiter 2 that's servicing all of America and spot it basically to cover all of Alaska for 20% of that funding. So my reason for being here to basically just give this message is that I think it's important that the legislature ask the FCC to update their Alaska plan and speak to all the options that are capable, so that at the end of this, Alaska has the very best infrastructure design taken in all the available technologies available today, so that we really come out of this in 10 years with the best infrastructure we can possibly have for our rural communities for the best price.
That's terrific information, Mr. Ashton. Hold on, we have some questions for you. Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Yes, I'm very excited with the presentation, and I'm pretty sure that there's far more satellites in the southern hemisphere than there are in the northern hemisphere. But are you aware of some of the work that both Google and Facebook are doing at this point as far as taking advantage of some of the technology with the low orbital satellites?
Yes, I am.
I'm just going to break in a moment. Alan McCabe and Mike Cook are back online. So go ahead and finish the response, and then we'll let them speak.
Well, actually, what I'd like you to do is ask that question again now that Alan McCabe is back online. And just, Alan, give me 20 seconds to recap to you. I was just letting them know about a conversation yesterday that with the amount of money that the FCC's Alaska plan is getting ready to pump into Alaska over the next 10 years, that I just suggested that the legislature ask the FCC to review that plan to make sure it's taken into consideration all the technologies that are available, so that in the end, Alaskan communities are basically, at the end of this 10-year plan, have the best communications infrastructure designed for the best price.
And my question was, knowing at this point that Google and Facebook and others are doing some pretty heavy lifting in this field in the southern hemisphere, and knowing that there's greater number of satellites in the southern hemisphere. Do you see a lot of opportunities for us in the north that could, where we could actually even be part of pilot projects for the same reasons that there are pilot projects in Africa?
So this is Mike Cook. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. We're very excited to be able to participate in the discussion here. So I'll get straight to the question you've asked, and then maybe I'll give a little bit of color around it at the end.
One second, Mr. Cook. This is Chair Drummond. If you would tell us your affiliation and before you proceed with your presentation.
Yes, of course. So I am Executive Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Hughes Network Systems. And Hughes Network Systems is the operator of the HughesNet service, which is a satellite internet service across the whole of the United States. We have it available in other countries as well. We have about 1 million subscribers, and we are providing direct internet access to people's homes. Will Johnson, if you remember, talked a little bit earlier on. We are just in the process of launching or turning on, I should say, our HughesNet Gen 5 service using a brand new satellite which is called EchoStar 19, which we launched from Cape Canaveral in December. It's the biggest data communication satellite in the world. It has the most advanced technology, as I say, we're just turning it on and coast to coast, and in the two beams that we have on EchoStar 19 covering Alaska, we are offering service plans that meet the FCC broadband specifications, the 25 down and the 3 up.
Excellent. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I think what you're talking about with Facebook and Google and so on is that they are involved in a number of different projects. I think the conversation when we joined here was talking about low Earth orbit satellites and some of the systems that are being talked about and in one case currently being developed. And the one that's in development right now is a system called OneWeb. Hughes is involved in that development because we are building all of the gateway, the ground infrastructure that will work with the OneWeb system. The OneWeb system is a low Earth orbiting system, which means that you have a lot of satellites, hundreds if not thousands of satellites, which are all constantly orbiting the Earth. So at any one time, you have a number of satellites that are in range of a particular, subscriber's home. And the system that the subscriber has is sort of constantly handing off from one satellite to another. But the key thing is that they're orbiting, and these low Earth orbit systems actually have coverage of the whole globe. Because since the satellite is orbiting today, or at this moment, it may be covering parts of the northern hemisphere, and in the next moment, it may be covering parts of the southern hemisphere. And the OneWeb system actually has the interesting benefit for Alaska that all the satellites are going to be in a polar orbit, which means that they will all have an orbit which goes over the North Pole. And then spreads out as they get to the equator, and they come back again and go over the South Pole. So, the benefit of these low Earth orbiting systems is that they do have a tremendous amount of coverage. They are in a lower orbit, so people talked a little bit about latency earlier on. The latency, in other words, the amount of time it takes for a signal to go from the ground to the satellite and back again. In a low Earth orbiting system is a little less. On the other hand, because they have thousands of satellites, each satellite is relatively small, and so the total amount of capacity that's available in the LEO systems is not as great as it can be in from a geostationary satellite. And I'll come back to that in a minute. And the state of development of the industry right now is that OneWeb have funding. They are building the system. There's a lot of new technology in it, and the plan, and I don't want to talk for them because they are a separate company that have their own plans and goals, and all I can say is that probably the expectation is that they'll be bringing that system into service somewhere in the 2019, 2020, 2021 timeframe. And that's the LEO system, as we call them, that is currently funded and under development. And there are people that are talking about, you know, possibly building other systems also in the future.
Okay, Mr. Cook, hold on briefly. We are at 10 a.m. committee. If I believe these folks are willing to continue speaking with us, if you wish to stay. All right, let's keep going. Go ahead, Mr. Cook.
Sure. Yeah, I'll be very brief, and then I'll let you ask any other questions you have. I'm sure you have many. In today's world, the state of the technology is that we are using these very large, very high throughput satellites. As I say, the satellite we're using today is 300 gigabits per second in capacity. It's the biggest data communication satellite in the world. And as we look forward, the technology is going to evolve not only in the LEO world, but also in the GEO world. And again, to give you an idea of the state of the art today, while we have service plans that we've launched into the market at 25 down and 3 up, the system capability is to deliver data to an individual terminal at 100 megabits per second and around 20 megabits per second up. So the system is much more capable than the service plans we're offering today. As we go forward, you know, we'll be looking at new generations of satellite systems that, again, will probably come on stream in another 3, 4, 5 years' time. And, you know, we would expect that the capabilities of these systems will go up again at that time. And the systems can deliver service directly to people's homes, or another application that might be very applicable in your circumstances in Alaska is they can also provide the satellite backhaul links to an expansion of, you know, local infrastructure to cover you know, towns and villages and so on in areas that are difficult to run cable all the way to. Satellite is a very, very effective backhaul mechanism for those sorts of systems.
Right. Mr. Cook, as you know, we're the Education Committee, and we're focusing on service to schools. But, of course, these are in very small, mostly in very small communities with a few hundred people, but some major needs. So I appreciate your focus and the excitement of this presentation. Are you nearly at the end?
Yeah, well, yes. I was going to stop there and just allow you to ask any questions or contribute in any other way you would like me to.
Excellent. Okay, questions for Mr. Cook. Mr. Fansler, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to thank our presenters, all of them today. You know, I think we heard about three very viable systems, and I think that this is going to be what it takes to get us to have broadband equity in our state for all school districts, and that's, I think, what everybody on this panel desires. I just wanted to say, you know, I hope that everyone can work together. We can work on making it affordable as well, as Representative Parrish mentioned before this. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Fansler. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cook, I had a question about, you know, what it costs to launch a new satellite, as we're sort of trying to understand kind of the equivalency of different kinds of services. How much does it cost to you know, launch another satellite, and what's the net capability in terms of megawatts per second, megabytes, sorry, per second, wrong issue, megabytes per second that we could expect to get from one satellite?
Yeah, good question. It won't surprise you to know that there's a number of different ways in which I could sort of answer that. But to give you an idea, a satellite can come in various sizes. If we're talking about these little LEO satellites, they are, in each case, relatively inexpensive, but to provide the service, you need a lot of them. And then at the other extreme, we have something like an EchoStar 19, which is a very large satellite physically as well as in terms of its capabilities. And it's quite expensive to build it, and it's quite expensive to launch it and so on. But to get directly to the point, if you think in terms of order of magnitude, about $500 million, that's roughly the cost of putting an EchoStar 19 type satellite into orbit. And then you obviously have 15 years of life out of it. And that is delivering somewhere in the region of 220 gigabits per second of capacity. To make that, to give you an idea of the way we think about it, you're talking about maybe $2 million per gigabyte, something of that rough order of magnitude. And to some extent, that's scalable, so you could have a slightly smaller satellite and you might still get there. But really, to get down to that level, you need to be building the big satellites and get the economy out of the launch, et cetera. But then, if you think about it, let's go to a sort of pie-in-the-sky sort of idea for a second. If you built a satellite for Alaska, you could build a satellite which concentrates the available capacity to some extent over the Alaskan mass. You could then right-size it in terms of its physical size and capabilities and power requirements and so on. And there are then ways of saying, well, maybe I don't need a whole satellite's worth of capacity for Alaska. Maybe I can do what's called a hosted payload and fly a part of the payload, which is covering Alaska, and then fly it on somebody else's satellite that is providing services maybe elsewhere in the U.S. or elsewhere in the hemisphere. And so you can, depending on what it is you're trying to achieve, there are several different paths to get an optimal configuration and cost for the sort of service that you're trying to deliver. Was that helpful?
Very, thank you.
Very helpful, sir. Thank you. Representative Parrish, you have an additional question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question, which I think you just answered, was about the lifespan of these potential satellites. The EchoStar 19, you said, is about 15 years of life. Is that pretty typical?
That's pretty typical for a geostationary satellite. With the low Earth orbiting satellites, the orbit decays a little bit more quickly, and an individual satellite would have a lower life. But then, because there are hundreds and thousands of them, if you put a low Earth orbit system in place, you have to have a plan for replenishing the satellites as they run out of life. But for a geo, 15 years is probably a typical life.
Thank you. The next question would be, I noticed in your presentation you say that you have a question. Could Alaska be a good place to launch from? So what would go into answering that question for you?
I'm not sure I said that. because when you launch a satellite, you really want to be as close to the equator as possible, and then that gives you optimal launch characteristics. So I wasn't saying you would physically launch the satellite from there, but you could design a satellite to provide coverage to Alaska.
Okay.
You would have it probably in a geostationary orbit, which means it's somewhere over the equator, but the beams, you can have, you can pick an orbital slot and have beams that are designed to cover Alaska, and you can design the capacity to a large extent where you need and want to have the capacity to meet the needs of the market in Alaska.
I see. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir. Any more questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Cook, for your patience and for getting back on the line with us. And thanks also to Mr. Ashton and Mr. McCabe.
We are over time. I wanted to note that Representative Chenault was in the room briefly during our meeting. Our next meeting is Monday, March 27th at 8 a.m. We have, again, a packed schedule, and we'll be taking up HB 102, Limited Teacher Certificates, HB 52, Pre-Elementary School Programs, and HB 146, School Tax, PFD Payment for School Tax. And with that, we are adjourned today at 10:11 a.m. Thank you.